country. So Kelly's election is a very frightening prospect.
Ari, talk about all that's at stake and the polls showing how significant abortion is when it comes to getting people out to vote. It looks like he's freezing. We're going to switch over to audio to be able to hear Ari Berman, who's national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones, who's written the report, "This Race Could Decide the Fate of Democracy in Wisconsin and the 2024 Election." Let's see if we can hear him right now. Ari, can you hear us?
Yes, Amy, can you hear me?
Perfect, perfect. This issue of abortion being a determinant of outcome, what the polls show about the issue getting people out to vote?
It's a huge issue in Wisconsin because right now, currently in effect, Wisconsin has an abortion ban from 1849 that went into effect immediately after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. That law from 1849 was passed 1 year after Wisconsin became a state by an all-male legislature. It's incredibly unpopular. 80% of Wisconsinites oppose the abortion ban, but the heavily gerrymandered legislature refuses to change it. And so that's a huge issue in this race because Democrats and the administration of Governor Tony Evers are currently challenging the abortion ban in state court, and it's likely to come before the state Supreme Court. And Judge Protasiewicz has said that she supports a woman's right to choose. So it's very possible there are enough votes on the court if she wins to strike down the 1849 abortion ban in Wisconsin and restore reproductive rights in the state.
And Ari, could you talk about how the Wisconsin Supreme Court has been vital in the GOP efforts at voter suppression and gerrymandering, and also in terms of dismantling campaign finance laws?
Well, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, with its conservative majority, has really been a driver of efforts to undermine democracy in Wisconsin. They have upheld basically every law passed by the legislature to entrench their own power. That includes some of the most gerrymandered maps in the country. That includes a series of laws making it harder to vote, such as a strict voter ID law, outlawing drop boxes, things of that nature. Wisconsin dismantled, basically, the Republicans dismantled, basically, some of the best campaign finance laws in the country. That's why there's been so much spending on the state Supreme Court election. That was also upheld by the state Supreme Court. So really, every time the state Supreme Court under conservative control has been asked whether or not they want to expand democracy or constrict democracy, they have fallen on the side of constricting democracy. And that's why the state Supreme Court election is potentially so significant, because it really is the only way to restore checks and balances in Wisconsin. Wisconsin already has a Democratic governor and a Democratic attorney general, but they have very little power because of the gerrymandered legislature's grip on the state. And the only way to get rid or to try to weaken the gerrymandered legislature's grip on the state is for those gerrymandered maps to be challenged and for there to be a branch of government that can actually challenge the legislature. Because right now, all the governor can do is veto the legislature's laws. But if the Wisconsin Supreme Court upholds those laws, then it's very difficult for there to be meaningful democracy in the state of Wisconsin.
And finally, Ari Berman, there's also a state Senate seat open.
There is, yeah. And that's very important because that's going to determine whether Senate Republicans have a two-thirds supermajority. If they get a two-thirds supermajority, they can then impeach state officials. And they've already talked about impeaching Judge Protasiewicz potentially if she wins the election today, which would be a really incredible power seizure. People are basically saying that would be a coup against democracy if progressives were to get a majority in the state Supreme Court, and then Republicans, because of their gerrymandered supermajority, would then try to impeach the judge that created that progressive majority. That would probably create some kind of constitutional crisis in the state of Wisconsin.
Ari Berman, I want to thank you for being with us, national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones. Again, we'll link to your report, This Race Could Decide the Fate of Democracy in Wisconsin and the 2024 election. Well, we're continuing with elections. Today, the special runoff election for Chicago mayor, where voters are choosing between two Democrats from different ends of the political spectrum, Brandon Johnson, organizer with the Chicago Teachers Union, and Paul Vallas, the former head of Chicago Public Schools, who's endorsed by the Chicago Police Union. Randy Weingarten, the president of AFT, American Federation of Teachers, has been in Chicago campaigning to back Johnson and criticized Paul Vallas. We thought we had a clip of Randy Weingarten, which we'll play in a minute. But Chicago is the third largest city in the United States. And today's runoff mayor election has drawn national attention. Juan, you're in Chicago. You've had these mayoral forum that you have been presiding over. Talk about the significance of this day.
Well, Amy, I'm still getting accustomed and learning the intricacies of local Chicago politics. But clearly, this race has the national implications as well. It raises the question of, can a progressive, multiracial coalition capture the mayoralty in the nation's third largest city, as Harold Washington did so 40 years ago, back in 1983? And the issues between the two supposed Democratic candidates are clear. Vallas is a centrist whose main focus throughout the campaign has been crime, crime, and crime. And he's backing the police department, increasing the number of police. He has not placed as much emphasis, however, on another aspect of his long-term policies, which have been the further privatization of public schools and the creation of more charter schools. And he's received major backing from the police unions and wealthy developers, real estate developers in the city. On the other hand, Brandon Johnson is a progressive who backs police reform, alternatives to policing, supports and defends, obviously, public education and taxing the rich. But the polls so far are showing, there was just one by Northwestern University a week ago, a very close race. About 44% of voters appear to be backing Brandon Johnson, 44% Vallas, with about 12% undecided. So what's going to be critical today is going to be, obviously, one turnout. Because the undecideds will have a big impact, but the question is who turns out to vote, and also what happens among Latino voters. And I think this has not gotten quite as much attention. When Harold Washington ran back in 1983, he got a big majority of the Latino vote, but back then there were only Latinos only represented about 16% of the city's population. Today they represent 29%. Of the city's population, almost double what it 40 years ago, and Johnson is not faring well so far, according to the polls. We don't know for sure because the polls are often wrong, but according to these polls, Vallas has considerable support among Latinos, about 46% to 35%. He's got just about 51% of the. Of support among white voters, and Brandon Johnson has a healthy majority among African-American voters, but not the overwhelming number that that Harold Washington had 40 years ago. One of the big things that's happened is many of the mayoral candidates, African-American mayoral candidates in the first round, are backing Vallas. Sophia King, Jamal Green, Edward Sawyer, Willie Wilson, they all ran for mayor in the first round, and they've all come out to back Vallas. In fact, the only candidate who ran for mayor in the Latino community, Jesus Chuy Garcia, is the only one of the candidates who is backing Brandon Johnson. It remains to be seen what happens in the Latino community. Unfortunately, I think Johnson has made a big mistake in not highlighting the support of Chuy Garcia. And what's happened is, according to the polls, about a third of Latino voters actually believe that Valles is a Latino. He's actually a descended from Greek-American immigrants. And so the reality is that there's confusion in the Latino community. There has not been enough outreach from the Johnson campaign. So it remains to be seen how the turnout will develop throughout the rest of the day. And we'll see what happens.
And this is Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers.
I watch Paul Valles ruin the New Orleans school system. I watch Paul Valles fire black teachers in New Orleans. I watch Paul Valles divide and tear that community apart and tear the Philadelphia community apart. I watched him do it. Of where Paul Valles stands than for Betsy DeVos is hack. I don't care what he says. For Betsy DeVos and her pack to come in and support Paul Valles tells you everything you need to know about him.
Randy Weingarten is head of AFT. Arnie Duncan, the former education secretary under Obama, and Senator Dick Durbin supported Valles. At the same time, you have Senators Warren and Bernie Sanders, right, Juan, coming out for Bernard Johnson.
For Brandon Johnson. Yes, absolutely. This is really a classic battle within the Democratic Party between progressives and the more conservative and centrist forces in the party. But we'll see now who is actually being able to reach the masses of the voters and turn them out in today's election.
Well, we want to thank you, Juan, for giving us that briefing. Of course, we're going to ask you about what happens tomorrow. Coming up, Finland joins NATO. Stay with us.
Wyclef told me call 911, but who do you call when the ambulances don't come? Or watches the ones sworn by law to protect us, wrongfully convict us, then call the corrections. Next, they build the banks up when we in recession and hang us in a jail cell so they can swing the elections. I walk Chicago streets with potholes as deep and Tahoe's creep like TLC. Hospital workers and scrubs with no PPE, but they got money for riot gear. We dying here, yeah. You tell me not to move with my gun, but we got more funeral homes than schools where I'm from. And on the news, all you view is homicides. Tell me why there ain't no trauma units when everybody traumatized. Trying to get on your feet, playing a hand they dealt you. If your house is not a home, let this song be your shelter, shelter, shelter.
I'll be your shelter. Emergency. Please count on me.
By Vic Mensa, Chance the Rapper, and Wyclef Jean. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Finland's formally joining NATO today in a move that doubles NATO's border with Russia. Finland and Russia share an 800-mile border. Finland's joining the military alliance a week after Turkey's parliament voted to ratify its membership. Turkey and Hungary have yet to approve Sweden as a member of NATO. The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has rejected Sweden's accession to NATO after accusing it of harboring Kurdish dissidents he considers terrorists and want extradited. Finland and Sweden has applied together to join NATO. They did in May of 2022, about 3 months after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This is NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg speaking today.
Today is an historic day because in a few hours we will welcome Finland as the 31st member of our alliance. This will make Finland safer and NATO stronger. By becoming a member, Finland will get an ironclad security guarantee. Article 5, our collective defense clause, one for all for one, will now, from today, apply for Finland.
The Kremlin has decried Finland joining NATO as a, quote, assault on our security, unquote. On Monday, Russian authorities announced they'll beef up its military presence in northwestern Russia. We're joined now by two guests. Rainer Braun is the former executive director of the International Peace Bureau, a German peace activist, historian, and author who's campaigned against the U.S. air base in Ramstein and against NATO. He's joining us from Berlin. And in Helsinki, Finland, we're joined by Alpha Harnier. He is a Finnish politician currently serving in the Parliament of Finland for the Green League at the Helsinki constituency. Let's begin with Alta Harjani. You are with the Green Party in Finland. It used to be opposed to joining NATO, but switched last year. Can you talk about why you feel today is so significant?
Today is, of course, significant, as we heard Mr. Stoltenberg talk there, that is a historic day as Finland joins the alliance. And I think we see it necessary in the time, but also not just guaranteeing and helping out to boost our security, but also us contributing more to the security of whole Europe. And the Green Party, we used to be a bit dubious towards the membership. Of course, everything changed in February 2020, and there has been a kind of like a also vocal proponents of NATO for years already, me included, for example. But yeah, everything pretty much changed with the Russian attack in Ukraine.
And what is your response to the Russian position that the continued expansion of NATO further eastward is actually a threat to Russia's security?
Well, I think it's very typical paranoid speech and the narrative of Kremlin, that it's kind of like some kind of surrounded fortress. The fact is that NATO is purely defensive alliance for Europe, and of course, it's the accession to NATO is based on each country's voluntary choice to do so. So it's purely, I think, paranoid Kremlin narrative that is that the main audience is actually the domestic audience there.
When you say purely defensive, I would think that people who live in Serbia or in Libya might question whether NATO is purely a defensive alliance.
Yep, well, that is true. Of course, NATO has been having a role also in this these operations, but looking at from the perspective of Finland joining the alliance, this is seen as completely a defensive act in order to kind of boost the European security as a whole. NATO as such poses no threat to Russia militarily, only in terms of securing defense and thus kind of providing a certain stop and limit for Russian aggression and the idea of creating this sphere of influence with aggressive policies or even with violence.
Rainer Braun, if you can respond from Berlin to what is happening today, Finland joining NATO, your response.
You know, it is not an historical day. The day today is the end of a longer story. Finland was all the last years a part of the NATO command and control system, a part of many NATO exercises, including NATO troops in Finland, and enlarging their military budget to over 2%, like NATO. So it is the end of a militarization of Finland and the whole region, and this day is not historical. It is a breakthrough of the history of Finland, which was a neutral country, from my understanding, with a lot of successes in peacekeeping missions, in having big international peace events like the Helsinki Conference for 1975. This time is over. And for what? For having more Russian troops nearer to the border? for having maybe even nuclear weapons on both sides. Now they are saying only on the Russian side and new nuclear weapons. But let us wait for 2 or 3 years. And this makes it again a step for the escalation in Europe and not a peaceful step. And frankly speaking, to say NATO is a defense military alliance, have we forgotten Libya? Have we forgotten Afghanistan? Have we forgotten Yugoslavia? I think this is really stupid. And let me say one more sentence to NATO. NATO said it's a North Atlantic Treaty Organization. This is not any longer true. NATO is the biggest military alliance in the world, with main focus also surrounding China, with all the new agreements with Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, Philippines, and. So it is the biggest, historically biggest military alliance in the world. And it is not definitely making peace. It is even creating many problems for peace and security.
Can you talk, Ronda Brown, about the significance of the German vice chancellor's surprise visit to Kiev?
You know, again, you know, quite all the members of the German parliament were visiting Kiev up to now. And the minister of economy was missing. And what he is doing, he was going with the big industry of our country. Because in the redeveloping of the country, in the reconstruction of the country, Ukraine, also the German industry wants to earn a lot of money. Like we are the profiteur of all the new developments in East Germany and in East Europe. And that is the main reason that he is going. And the interesting point is that they are discussing about the reconstruction of Ukraine. But what is needed for the reconstruction of Ukraine? The first step must be ceasefire and negotiations. So hopefully the Minister Habeck will come to the great idea to support our position that immediately ceasefire and negotiation for Ukraine are needed, that we can start with the reconstruction of this heavily destroyed country.
Ronda Brown, if you can talk about the proposal put forward by German politicians for a negotiation that the Ukrainian President Zelensky rejected this weekend.
You know, interestingly, he rejected our appeal by his deputy foreign minister, but he's supporting the suggestions from China, which are quite on the same level, saying we need negotiations for overcoming this brutal war. And the idea behind it is that no one can win this war militarily. So the alternative is continuing of day-to-day killing. We have more than 200,000 dead people up to now. And when we are thinking about the so-called military spring offensives, we will have maybe again the same number. What is the alternative? The alternative is not to accept the actual situation, but to stop the war and start for negotiations about a new development in Ukraine and a new peace process in Europe. And our suggestion is that it's impossible to do this from the European perspectives, because the European countries, but all, are deeply engaged in the war by training the Ukrainian soldiers, by sending weapons, by spy offensives, and by security purposes. So the only possibility is that we have an international peace coalition coming from the global south, being the moderator or mediator for a peace process. And this is why we are saying we are supporting the suggestion of Brazil and China, Indonesia and India to develop such a peace coalition. And we hope that this peace coalition will get the support of the government of Germany and France. In any case, we will work for this. And this could create an atmosphere for coming to negotiations and for stopping these day-to-day killing and for opening the door for a peaceful and better future for Ukraine, but for the whole Europe, because the alternative is the escalation. And we see it with the depleted uranium. We see it with the new nukes in Belarus. We are step by step escalating the situation, which has a danger to lead to a nuclear war. The alternative is negotiations and ceasefire.
And I'd like to bring in Ate Harnje again to talk about this issue of, is a ceasefire and negotiations possible toward a diplomatic solution of the war? You've advocated in the past pushing European governments to offer more military weaponry to Ukraine.
Yeah. And I think the clear thing is here that negotiations over about peace cannot be done over the heads of the Ukrainians. Ukraine is a sovereign nation being under criminal assault by Russia. So we have to avoid this false symmetry in the situation. About escalation, it pretty much seems that Russia is kind of just using the escalation thing as a basis to kind of try to limit the support for Ukraine. And we should make sure that as democratic Western countries, we make sure that we help Ukrainians to protect their own sovereignty, their own human lives, their freedom, and also the values to be held dear. But of course, in the end, after war comes peace. And we have to make sure that there is room for peace, but it cannot be negotiated over Ukrainians. So they have had to say over the terms. And in the meantime, it's very important to keep the military support and the civil support on a level that helps the Ukrainians to gain the upper hand and maintain the upper hand in this war, which is completely the whole responsibility over the war lies in Russia and in Kremlin.
Ate Harjanne, if you can also talk about the election that just took place in Finland. You have a new prime minister, correct me if I'm mispronouncing his name, Petteri Orpo, who eked out a victory at 20.8% of the vote, center-right National Coalition Party, against the prime minister Marin's party, the center-left Social Democrats, who got almost 20%. These are very small numbers. What does this mean for Finland?
Well, I think it means a kind of turn towards a more conservative right-wing path. I think the main issue here is the economy. So kind of the prime goal of the new prime minister is to combat the debt and balance the economy of Finland. So that's been the main issue regarding the elections, regarding foreign and security policy. As you know, the NATO decision in Finland was done with overwhelming majority. No parliamentary body or parties has been opposing really the accession. So probably it's clear that the foreign and security policy line, the idea that we're committed to NATO. And also committed to support Ukraine. I don't see any major changes there. Prime Minister Marin, she did eke out a victory so that her party gained more seats, which is quite unusual for a sitting prime minister. And she's still, as a person, gained a massive amount of votes in her constituency. But the issue rather is domestic and largely economic and regional economic matters that really decided the vote, so to say.
As Reiner Braun, we only have about 30 seconds or so, but could you talk about the anti-war movement in Germany, your plans for April, and how the German media is covering the war in Ukraine?
You know, we are in front of our Easter marches. We will have 10,000 of people on the street during the next days. That are one step of our big activities. And, you know, we are following up the big activities in Munich and Berlin in the beginning of the year. But to my colleague, he has a misunderstanding of the war. It's not only Russia and Ukraine in the war. It's a proxy war and a civil war. And to say the whole responsibility lies by Russia, these underestimate the development to the war, and I think this is a really big mistake not to see what's happening with the Minsk agreement and why our chancellor and Macron was lying about the Minsk agreement and don't want to make it. So I think it is really very much too easy to say that the whole responsibility lies with Russia.
Rhona Braun, we're going to have to leave it there. We thank you so much, former executive director of the International Peace Bureau, and Outa Harjanne, a Green member of parliament in Finland. I'm Amy Goodman-Juan-Gonzalez.
You're listening to Looking at Lyme on CJSF's Speak Up, and I'm your host, Sarah Cormode. Looking at Lyme is a podcast all about Lyme disease. My own journey back to health motivated me to understand the complexities of the illness, testing, diagnosis, and treatment. In each episode, you'll hear from experts in the field of medicine, science, and outdoor education. Together, we learn about topics such as neuroplasticity, pain management, co-infections, outdoor safety, and tick surveillance. You can find out more by visiting our website, lookingatlyme.ca, or following us on Twitter or Instagram. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to hear new episodes.